Hello, it's John Dennis on Thursday, the 5th of February. Today, the government is under pressure to make a statement on the alleged torture of a Briton held at Guantanamo Bay. High Court judges said evidence of torture must be kept secret because of American threats.
I can't tell you exactly what they're suppressing. I've seen it, but you can't know because it's classified.
Also today, oil refinery workers who took part in wildcat strikes over the use of foreign labour decide today whether to return to work.
This is a magnificent claim down from the management and a magnificent victory for the trade union movement.
And you'll hear from the man who discovered the biggest snake known to man. Don't worry, it died 60 million years ago.
13 metres long, with a mass of 1.25 tons. It's about the length of a Tyrannosaurus rat.
Guardian Daily with John Dennis on guardian.co.uk.
But first, Sandy Waugh with today's news and the papers.
There were fresh snowfalls across the west of England, the Midlands and Wales during the night. Several inches are expected by forecasters. The M4, M5 and M1 in the Midlands are badly affected. The runway at Luton Airport's been closed. Schools are closed in Wales and there are expected to be more closures in the West Country from Wiltshire to Devon. Meanwhile, local councils say they're running out of salt and grit and are concentrating on main roads only. The British Council has suspended its work in Iran. British staff have been denied visas to work in the country for the last 2 years, but now the local Iranian staff of 16 have been told they must resign. The chief executive of the council said they'd been summoned to the president's office to be given the order to quit. A year ago, the council had to give up work in Russia after similar pressure. A meeting of workers at the Total oil refinery in Lincolnshire is expected to vote for an end to their unofficial strike. They've been offered half the jobs in a new contract won by an Italian company. The dispute led to wildcat strikes at other energy plants. Another row has broken out at a Nottinghamshire power station, Staythorpe. Unemployed building workers say they've been refused work there. We'll hear from the workers in Lindsay shortly. In the USA, the Senate has voted to soften the Buy American clause in the economic recovery bill. It had originally stated that any building work financed by the plan should use American materials such as iron and steel. But after complaints from the European Union, it's been amended to follow international trade agreements. Meanwhile, President Obama has put a ceiling on the wages of bank bosses bailed out by the government. They won't be allowed to earn more than $500,000 a year. The president also said he'd clamp down on what he called the customary lavish bonuses. Here in Britain, the Bank of England will announce the latest interest rates today. They're expected to be cut by another half percentage point to a record low of 1%. Sport in the first test between England and the West Indies. England reached 236 for 5, thanks to a powerful 97 by deposed captain Kevin Peterson. In the FA Cup replay, Everton knocked out local rivals Liverpool with a goal in extra time by 19-year-old Dan Gosling. There was fury in the city over the fact that ITV had put on adverts before the end of the game and so missed the goal. In the papers, The Guardian and The Telegraph lead on the story about alleged torture of a Briton in Guantanamo. The Telegraph headline reads, "Judges accuse US of torture cover-up," while The Guardian aims the blame back home, saying evidence of torture buried by ministers. We'll have the full story in a moment. The Financial Times tells us that Obama gets tough on pay for executives, while The Times brings it back home again, saying that bailed-out bankers set for millions in bonuses. It claims that Royal Bank of Scotland is planning large bonuses for city traders and bankers. The Independent joins the FT in putting the story of the Icelandic business group, which owns a big stake in British High Street, on its front page. For sale, the British High Street, it says, saying the company has holdings in 20 chains. The FT believes the company, Bauger, may fall into administration. The paper also reports that the European Commissioner on Unemployment says he'll take a closer look at the rules on free movement of labour after the dispute in Britain over foreign workers. Finally, the Mail and the Sun keeps the story going of Carol Thatcher being sacked by the BBC for talking about gollywogs. "Queen sells gollies," shouts the Sun. £10 dolls in Sandringham shop. Buckingham Palace issued an extraordinary apology last night, says the Mail. More on the day's news and breaking stories at guardian.co.uk.
Evidence of how a British resident held in the Guantanamo Bay detention camp was tortured and what MI5 knew about it must remain secret after a ruling in the High Court in London yesterday. The judges said they were deeply unhappy with their decision but said they had no alternative because David Miliband, the Foreign Secretary, said if the evidence was disclosed, then the US would stop sharing intelligence with Britain. And that would directly threaten the UK's national security, Miliband told the court. Well, the Briton in question is Binyam Mohammed, and his lawyer is Clive Stafford Smith. He welcomed the judgment because it forces the British and American governments to answer some questions.
Well, it's fantastic, isn't it? I think it seems like it's negative in the sense that it doesn't order the release of the material. But actually what it does is it forces the government of both the US and the UK to state publicly whether they really want to suppress evidence of torture. And this is going to be very powerful.
I mean, who's suppressing what here, Clive?
Well, I can't tell you exactly what they're suppressing. I've seen it, but you can't know because it's classified. I think everyone can assume from the judgment it's really compelling evidence that American personnel and British have committed the criminal offence of torture against Binyam Mohammed. But you're not allowed to know that because the British government says that it's classified. And worse yet, the reason that they say it's classified is because they've been threatened by the Americans, by the Bush administration, that if they reveal the truth about torture, they'll get sanctioned for it. And that's a scandal.
Meanwhile, Clive, in what conditions is Binyam Mohammed currently being held?
Lieutenant Colonel Bradley was seeing him just on Friday. He's now been on hunger strike for over a month, and he's very weak. And he's finding this whole process of the uncertainty about whether he's ever going to come home very difficult. It's becoming increasingly urgent that we get him home. His health is deteriorating.
And have things improved for him at all since the new American administration of President Barack Obama came into power?
No, there's been absolutely no betterment of his condition. Indeed, they've been worse in some ways because there are now a number of prisoners on hunger strike and they're being very badly treated. One of my other clients right near Binyam, in Binyam's vision, got beaten up terribly badly. And so I think things have got worse there. It obviously hasn't filtered down to Guantanamo that we have a new president.
When will Binyam Mohammed be freed?
It's impossible for me to say when he'll be free. I mean, I have said, and I still believe, that it's going to be very soon. All the indicators are that he will be set free. It is absolutely beyond me why he's not home in Britain already.
Clive Stafford Smith, and there's full coverage of that story today at guardian.co.uk/Guantanamo. Also on The Guardian's website, John Hooper on the six crucial questions that need to be addressed in the trial in Perugia, in Italy, of Amanda Knox over the murder of the British student Meredith Kircher. Read about that at guardian.co.uk/Italy. Jonathan Friedland says that Obama's screw-up with Tom Daschle is a misstep but hardly a fatal flaw. Have your say at guardian.co.uk/comment is free. And Richard Gott on the charms of protectionism at guardian.co.uk/business. California's cities face collapse, and its agriculture could vanish by the end of the century unless drastic action is taken to combat climate change. That's according to Stephen Chu, the new energy secretary in Barack Obama's administration. Our environment correspondent in Washington is Suzanne Goldenberg. She says Mr. Chu has warned America to wake up to the dangers of global warming.
We've had very strong words indeed from the energy secretary. He's saying that the American public really doesn't quite understand the gravity of climate change and how much Americans are going to be affected. He's warning of a sort of apocalypse, really, for agriculture in California, for the wine industry. He's talked about water shortages in the West and upper Midwest, and sort of terrible consequences across the country.
California is one of the states that is more progressive than many other parts of America, though, isn't it?
Absolutely. California has made quite great strides in trying to deal with climate change, and much greater than the federal government, especially under George Bush. I think if you look at this in the wider context, what you are seeing now is members of the Obama administration and also key Democratic leaders in Congress really making a very strong and coordinated push for Americans to deal with global warming. Almost every day now in Washington, there are events on climate change, on the environment, on the green economy, on green jobs, on Capitol Hill in terms of hearings in Congress and conventions and conferences. There is a real awareness right now, or real attempt to build awareness, so that there will be legislation dealing with greenhouse gas emissions. I mean, there is this broadening sense among people like Chu and environmentalists that so much time was lost when George Bush was president that really there's this is a matter of great urgency. Americans have to move now, and that they can't let the economic turndown and recession hold back action on climate change.
How easy will it be for the Obama administration to push through laws that presumably will have to be quite radical in order to meet the grim challenges that Mr. Chu describes?
Well, we're about to discover that. I mean, the first order of business really is this big economic stimulus package, this rescue plan. Now, what Obama has done that is different from any other American president is that he has said that the environment has to be at the center of any economic recovery plan. That package is still before Congress, and what is going to happen now is, to what extent is he able to sort of make the jobs created here green jobs? To what extent is he going to be able to increase investment in public transport? So the first sort of results of this new green agenda could be seen as early as mid-February, when the Congress eventually passes an economic rescue plan. We'll see some green action there. Further down the line, we saw earlier this week the Democratic leaders in Senate line up and say that they hope to produce legislation to curb greenhouse gas emissions before the end of this calendar year.
Suzanne Goldenberg in Washington. I'm John Dennis. Still to come in Guardian Daily, the Italian chef Antonio Carluccio explains why you won't hear him swearing and shouting in the kitchen unless someone wants spaghetti bolognese.
I hope to become the best Italian restaurant in Delhi.
But first, the Iceland-based retail giant Bauga is considering selling its assets today after talks aimed at managing its £1 billion UK debt collapsed. Bauga owns all or part of about 3,500 high street stores, including Hamleys, French Connection and the House of Fraser. It has a turnover of more than £5 billion and it employs over 50,000 people in the UK. But yesterday in Reykjavik, it applied to enter the moratorium process, which offers protection from creditors, a bit like Chapter 11 bankruptcy procedures in the US. Our business editor is Deborah Hargreaves.
Bauga, obviously not a household name, owned by Icelandic banks, and a very flamboyant Icelandic entrepreneur called John Asger Johansson. But it is the name behind a lot of high street brands, fashion companies like Karen Millen and Oasis, Iceland Supermarket, it owns part of that, House of Fraser, the Matthew Williamson designer label, Whistles, Hamleys, Goldsmith, Mappin & Webb, Wyvale Garden Centres. They have stakes in a whole load of retail businesses across the UK.
And why has Bauga got into trouble?
Bauga's got a lot of debt. It's been on a real acquisition trail over the past few years, funding its acquisitions with debt. Obviously, it's very difficult to fund debt at the moment. The Icelandic banks have pulled the plug and are calling in their debts. The company can't pay. It's gone into administration in Iceland, and administrators here are likely to be appointed towards the end of the week. There's some dispute about where the administration process takes place, but it will probably be in the UK because the company is now headquartered in Bond Street. In fact, they closed their Reykjavik office not that long ago.
What will be its options as it looks to ways to repay its creditors?
Well, one of the main options is to sell off some of the businesses. That isn't very easy at the moment because obviously no one wants to buy retail businesses right now. Very few people have got the money to spend. They'll be looking for cash buyers like Philip Green, the owner of Topshop. but they could just wait and sell the businesses a bit later. As long as trading carries on and those businesses are bringing in money, the administrators could run them and sell them later on when the market's picked up a bit. They could do something else known as a debt for equity swap, which would involve banks owning a stake in the businesses in exchange for cancelling the debts. So there are a number of options. But this is a very big group. It employs 50,000 people in the UK. So there will be fears for job losses again on the high street.
Deborah Hargreaves. Staff at the Lindsay Oil Refinery in Lincolnshire are voting today on proposals to end the row over the use of foreign labour. After 2 days of talks between unions and the energy company Total, the firm offered to guarantee that 50% of jobs would go to UK workers. Martin Wainwright reports from North Lincolnshire.
I'm at Killingholme on Humberside outside the Lindsay Oil Refinery, where all the fuss is going off about the foreign workers working on the new desulfurisation plants. I've just been talking to one very nice, quietly spoken man. He didn't want to be recorded, but he was giving me some of the detail about why people feel strongly about this. And like everybody I've spoken to, he was very anxious to emphasise there's nothing racist about this. They're not anti-foreign workers per se. But he was saying they've got really serious concerns as craft workers themselves about the qualifications of some of the workers coming in from Italy, the ones who are living on the barge in Grimsby. He said there's a lot of hotheads here now, and actually I'm just coming up to the car park where there's a union jack and there's big crowds of people, a lot of people here today, far more than there have been previously. I'm just with one of the GMB negotiators.
My name's Phil Whitehurst. This time last week there was no UK labour going to be employed on that part of the contract. And we've been given 102 new postings for the UK workers. There's been no exclusion of Italian or Portuguese workers to make these jobs. There's the new jobs created to forward the project. And so I think everybody should be happy.
It's like a win-win by the sound of it.
Well, this is what we've had. We've been assured by Jacobs and Total that this is the situation. So yes, in effect, it is a win-win situation. And I'm proud of the brave lads what took the stand, and also the brave lads what's come out to support us as well.
Good. And one last question: these are skill jobs. I mean, it's not like the British getting. Somebody was telling me today, you know, we don't want to be pushing around the tea trolley. It presumably isn't that, so no.
No, we've got. It's a 50-50 mix. There's skilled tradespersons, but also then there's semi-skilled. But that doesn't detract from these. Are British workers. They're not people pushing tea trolleys down.
Guardian Daily. News and reports from around the world.
At the site of an ancient South American rainforest, scientists have uncovered remains of the biggest snake ever known. The monster relative of the boa constrictor lived in northern Colombia 60 million years ago. Paleontologist Dr. Jonathan Block from the University of Florida at Gainesville was one of the leaders of the expedition to Colombia.
The fossils that we found of Titanoboa are mostly, if you think of a snake, they're mostly back parts of the backbone, really a whole snake. A snake is mostly made up of bones of the backbone, if you think of the bones that compose the body. So really we have a bunch of vertebrae and ribs of a snake that would have been around 13 meters long with a mass of one and a quarter tons. And the snake itself would have, in terms of thinking about how long that would have been, it would have been about the size of a school bus in length. Or another way to think about it is if you're familiar with the very large specimens of Tyrannosaurus rex that have been described in the past, for example, Sue at the Field Museum, it's about the length of a Tyrannosaurus rex.
I mean, this is the stuff of Hollywood horror movies, isn't it?
Yeah, so the only way to really imagine sort of the interface between humans and snakes of this size, really you have to go to Hollywood and into the make-believe. But what's incredibly interesting is that, in fact, the Hollywood directors didn't even get it as big as this. So if you look at the Anaconda movie, for example, the anaconda depicted in that movie was not as large as the one that we described.
What would this creature have eaten?
We think that Titanoboa would have eaten probably a diet of fish, large fish, and then probably a healthy diet of crocodiles as well.
What does it tell us about what the environment in what's now Colombia would have been like 60 million years ago?
We believe that in order for a snake of this size to live, it would have had to be very, it would have had to have been very warm back then, so warmer than today. So the climate itself would have been 30 to 34 degrees Celsius, which is very hot, and that would explain why the snake got so big. But in terms of the environment that it lived in, it would have lived in a riverine type of system very close to the ocean. And we know that based on the rocks that it's preserved in. And we also know that in part based on the habits of the other types of animals that we find in those same rocks. So we find fish that are related to bonefish and tarpon today. We also find a very aquatic type of freshwater turtles, and also these extinct group of crocodiles that all would have lived in these large riverine systems. If you look at modern anacondas today, they spend a lot of time in the water. So we think Titanoboa would also have spent a lot of time in the water. We also have many plant fossils from the Cerrejón coal mine that tell us quite a bit about the forest that these animals would have lived in. It's a remarkable forest. It's the oldest rainforest that we know of, and it tells us quite a bit about sort of the initial stages of the evolution of the Amazonian type of ecosystem.
Dr. Jonathan Block. For more than three decades now, Antonio Carluccio has been on a mission to convert Britain to the merits of Italian cuisine. And he's had quite a bit of success, as he told The Guardian's Hannah Poole.
How does it feel when you walk past a Carluccio's now?
Oh, well, a bit nostalgic, obviously, and the name is still there, and I am attempting also to get in and check a little bit.
Have you been in?
Oh, yeah, many times. And I buy also bits and pieces because I know what food it is.
What do you buy?
Well, all bits and pieces, so good parmesan, good salamis, and things like this, pasta, and rice, and oils.
You feel a bit nostalgic when you walk past. Do you regret that the contract was written up in such a way? Do you regret selling the business?
I was then afterwards a consultant for a couple of years, and I could still mix myself with that. But I think it's we brought the entire thing on a good way, and apparently it's going very well.
You've become a sort of ambassador of Italian food in exile. How often do you go back?
Well, my exile, self-imposed. In fact, I can look after Italian cooking better here than not in Italy. But I go quite often back to Italy for business, and now I just came back from India, where there I teach about a group of, I taught three times now, 10 days each, a group of 20 chefs to open a new Italian restaurant in Delhi. And I hope to become the best Italian restaurant in Delhi.
Antonio Carluccio talking to Hannah Poole. Andy Duckworth and Tim Mabey produced today's edition of Guardian Daily. I'm John Dennis. Thank you for listening.